This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moscawen. You know, it's easy to get caught up in what's wrong with the world. This hour, we're going to talk about some things that are right, and more importantly, what works when it comes to helping other people and why. The Pulitzer Prize-winning husband and wife team of Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudun are out with a new book on that topic. It's called A Path Appears, and Nicholas Kristof joins us. Welcome to Radio Times.
Delighted to be here.
Well, it's good to have you. And wait, I want to start just a big overall sort of question here. Why do you think the world needs this book right now?
You know, I guess there are maybe a couple of reasons. Cheryl and I, after we wrote our last book, Half the Sky, about empowering women around the world, people kept approaching us and asking, so what can I do? And we partly wanted to address that. You know, 2/3 of Americans donate to charity each year or volunteer, and I think we all recognize that it's not always as effective as we might hope. And I guess the other reason is that inequality is a huge debate around the country, rightly so, but it feels to us as if a lot of our interventions over the last half century haven't been as effective as they might have been, and that we can do a better job of creating opportunity, and that there is some real evidence now that has emerged from careful research about what kind of interventions will do a better job in creating that opportunity.
So it's not just good intentions that
yeah.
help people.
No, that's so often we measure our kind of philanthropic commitment by inputs. I know how big a check we write to an organization, or you know, how many hours we volunteer, or whatever it may be. And you know, what's really more important at the end of the day is impact.
I also get a sense that you're sort of trying to take some of the cynicism out of philanthropy, and kind of keeping it real by evidence base and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, one of the balancing acts that Cheryl and I pursued in writing A Path Appears is that, you know, look, at the end of the day, there are a lot of charities that are ineffective, that waste money, that are not run right, and we often hear from them. You know, we'll get a call from some organization, and in the phone call, it'll mention children with cancer, or it'll mention veterans, or whatever the cause may be, and you know, that's a pretty effective strategy for raising money. It's not always a great strategy for spending money. And so we wanted to criticize, you know, a lot of areas in charity that are ineffective, but we didn't want to drive people away from the idea of donating or volunteering or advocating, which we think really can make a big difference.
And you try to explain that it's not so complicated either. I mean, and, you know, sometimes you can look at those big problems and they seem so big and I feel so small that what can I do about that?
Yeah, I think that we have the mistaken impression that to have an impact, to make a difference, you have to solve a problem. And obviously, we're not going to solve the problem of whatever, girls' education or malaria. I mean, that's not going to happen. But we can make a difference fairly easily in the life of a particular person out there. You know, we can sponsor a particular kid so that kid will get an education. We can pay for a girl's school uniform so she can go to school. We can provide bed nets for a few people. And that doesn't solve the global problem, but for those people, it truly can be transformative.
And you tell a great story about your own father.
Yeah, which I haven't really talked about much in the past, but wrote about it in A Path Appears. And maybe subconsciously, it's one reason why I do believe in, you know, the drops in the bucket count. My dad was a World War II refugee, fled Romania, and was in a concentration camp in Yugoslavia, which was executing some refugees and releasing some to the West. And a French diplomat wrote a brief inquiry about my dad to the Yugoslav government, and we think that was why he was released. And then he made his way to Paris and was, you know, penniless, was cleaning hotel rooms. And there was a young woman from Portland, Oregon, who was in one of the hotel rooms that my dad was cleaning and liked him, and he wanted to come to America, and she persuaded her parents to sponsor his way to come to the U.S., even though, you know, they'd never met him. They got their church, which was the Presbyterian Church, to sponsor him even though he was Catholic. They took a risk on him, and it, you know, didn't solve the global refugee problem at all, but it was completely transformative for my dad, and you know, I wouldn't be here right now if they hadn't taken that risk.
Just that one little note that French diplomat wrote, and it made all the difference.
Absolutely.
So I want to talk about some of the organizations that you highlight in the book, especially in the first part of the book. You really just kind of start going through different organizations, and it's almost like we're gorging ourselves on people who are sort of effectively doing stuff. And considering how cynical the world can be, it feels kind of good to go through all of that. And one of them is here in Philadelphia, the Springboard Collaborative. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it's a terrific organization started by a young man who was originally a Teach for American teacher. And he was sort of proud of his teaching ability, and he then tested his students to see how much progress they were making. And then he was really dispirited in the fall when he realized that they still had not caught up to where they had been at the end of the previous school year because of this long summer slide. And, you know, middle-class kids are dragged around all summer to the library or to music classes or to summer school, and so they don't have as much of a summer slide. But low-income kids, they lose a huge amount each summer. And so this young man decided to start a program, Springboard Collaborative, and it basically gives these low-income, at-risk kids a chance to really learn something in summer, to maintain their skills or advance their skills. And Springboard really uses metrics very, very carefully, so you can really see the impact on each kid. And it's, you know, astonishing how much it has, and I would love to see it expanded not only here in Philadelphia to provide a little more of a, you know, equal access to education, but frankly, across the country as well.
I had never heard of the group. I live here in Philadelphia, but I hadn't heard of it. So I looked into it a little bit more. The fellow's name is Alejandro Gack Artigas, and a young guy, and just was teaching first grade, and it was exactly what you're talking about. He identified, I mean, it's a really big problem, but he was looking at the people right in front of him.
Yeah, and it was a reminder, you know, that there are solutions. And again, that's, you know, it's not going to solve the education problems for everybody, but it really does feel to me that one of the, you know, maybe the best escalator out of poverty, whether you're talking about Philadelphia or Zimbabwe, is education. And that one of the commonalities also is that whether it's you're talking about Zimbabwe or Philadelphia, that escalator is broken for the kids who most need it. How do we fix it? There are many, many things that need fixing, including early childhood education. But that summer slide problem is a huge one. And Alejandro identified a solution that works, that is relatively cheap. He also allows donors to sponsor a particular kid, I think $350 for a summer session. And, you know, what a bargain if you can get a kid actually on the path toward education and self-help and to love reading, for example.
Yeah, as I remember, he was finding that the kids would come back from summer and they'd be like back where they were in April or something
exactly.
Like that. And so it would take until Thanksgiving to get them back to where they had been. And so by having a summer program, you can kind of keep that that learning going instead of having that pause. And a lot of what you talk about in your book is about reaching kids early in life and doing something early and how that can kind of be and create the payoff that a lot of us want.
Yeah, I think that you know, one of the reasons why our interventions haven't been more successful is that they come in too late. And the brain is developing at a furious rate for the first 1,000 days after conception. And that's the period when, you know, there's no public investment in the kids. We begin the public investment in, you know, in the elementary system. And we really pour the money in college when, for many kids, it's just too late. And you know, and the other, you know, the other kind of politically awkward part of this is that there is not only a income gap and a wealth gap, but there's kind of a parenting gap. And this raises all kinds of delicate issues, but it's also clear that it's not as if parents want to raise a kid who isn't doing well in school. They're raising their child the way they were raised, maybe not reading to their kid, not speaking to their child that much. And if you give them a helping hand and, you know, children's books, for example, many homes don't have a single children's book. If you give them access to that, encourage them to read to the child, talk to the child, then it has a remarkable effect.
You point to some research from two people, Betty Hart and Todd Risley, and they look at they look at how many words a child hears. And I mean, this is the stuff that we can all sort of grab on to, right? These are hard numbers.
That's right. By age 4, a child of professionals will have heard 30 million more words than a child on welfare. And both kids, that child on welfare and the child of professionals, they begin to speak at the same time. I mean, they seem to have equal verbal capacity, but because that child of professionals is hearing so many more words all the time and is being encouraged all the time, then that child is going to become more verbal, is going to be better prepared for school, and the other child just starts at a tremendous disadvantage.
And it's not because those working class or poor parents don't want to speak to their children as much. So they may not be the time.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's kind of two things going on. One is that if you're a single parent, you're under enormous stress, and you probably have access to only pretty lousy, you know, child care, which may involve parking a kid in front of a TV. And one of the real lessons of that study was TV doesn't count. And also, there is kind of a working class tradition that involves less talking to kids and kind of cuckooing over kids. And if you tell people how important it is, then they change their behaviors. They talk more.
Okay, so I just learned something new from you, that children from different socioeconomic classes may not get the same exposure to the number of words as kids from a more middle class or upper middle class upbringing. What can I do about something like that?
So there are a number of interventions that have been, incredibly effective at this. One that is just so cheap is called Reach Out and Read, which was founded by a group of pediatricians who noted that they were worrying about, kids' runny noses, but weren't worrying about something that was far more important to their long-term development, which was their cognitive development. And they saw many of these kids that they were seeing, low-income kids, they didn't have a single children's book at home, they were never being read to, and their verbal capacity wasn't developing. So they started Reach Out and Read, and the pediatricians give a donated book to a child on each visit, and they give a prescription for reading to the parents and kind of advise them, that you should be reading every day and talk to your child. And they've measured this using randomized controlled trials, the gold standard of evidence, and they find that it has a dramatic impact and that reading is much more likely to be a favorite activity in that household. And those kids learn many more words. They have a better vocabulary later on. They're much better prepared for school. And it costs only $20 a year to sponsor a child in that program, $20 a year. And yet, because of funding constraints, it still only reaches one-third of the target kids. And, it just seems the question isn't whether we can afford a program like that. It's how can we afford not to invest in it?
We're talking about a book New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof wrote with his wife, Cheryl Wu Dunn. And we have half the writing team here with us. Nicholas Kristof is in the studio for the whole hour. If you have questions for him or comments on what we're talking about, you can call us up, join the discussion at 1-888-477-9499. Also, you can send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be back after a break.
Supporting WHYY, Wheaton Arts in Millville, New Jersey, presents the Festival of Fine Craft, Saturday and Sunday, October 4th and 5th, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., both days, rain or shine. This arts festival celebrates the best of American craft. The event features traditional and contemporary work from over 130 juried artists, plus indoor and outdoor craft demonstrations, hands-on family activities, musical entertainment, specialty foods, and the popular glass pumpkin patch. Details online at wheatonarts.org.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Lawmakers in Washington can barely plan out the next 6 months. Is anyone thinking about the distant future?
We have lost a capacity that allows our government to start articulating what it is that we want our place in the world to look like in 50 or 100 years.
Playing the long game, next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Doctors are committed to making sure patients stay healthy, but who takes care of the healthcare system as a whole? If you work in public health, you do. And Jefferson School of Population Health can help you to join this growing field with their Master of Public Health program. Register for an information session on October 15th at 5:30 p.m. for classes starting in January by visiting jefferson.edu/pophealthinfosession. Jefferson supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady. We're talking about a new book Nicholas Kristof wrote with his wife. It's entitled A Path Appears, Transforming Lives, Creating Opportunity. If you want to join the conversation, the phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We've been talking about how intervening in someone's life very early on can have a huge effect. But you also have examples of helping people around the world. And I loved the story of Biddy Rose Nassoni. Am I saying the name
That's
correctly?
That's exactly right.
And tell me a little bit about her.
Sure. So she's a 39-year-old woman in Malawi in southern Africa. And she was very poor. And she was a farmer, and just always living right at the edge. Two of her children had died of, it was a little unclear what of, because they'd never been taken to a hospital and they'd never seen a doctor. And then there was a program that was started by CARE, in the area, called a Village Savings and Loan. And a lot of people have heard of microfinance, but usually microfinance is about micro-lending. This was micro-savings. This was helping the villagers start their own little savings and loan program. And so Biddy Rose joined one of these groups, and about 20 women would meet regularly, and they would bring tiny sums of money, I mean a few cents each, and pool that together and then lend it out to one of the people there to invest in some small business. So Biddy Rose invested in a little donut business. She sold the donuts for 2 cents each, and she became a terrific donut maker. And then she began using the profits from that to expand her agricultural operation and to buy fertilizer, this kind of thing. She also, as she became more successful, her husband, who was a bit of a drip, frankly, began, he was kind of forced to respect her. And he had been spending the hard-earned family money, the negligible little bit of money that they had, on alcohol and on prostitutes, which, you know, created a lot of tensions in the family. But as she became more successful, instead of then taking more money and spending it on drink or women, he actually began to use it more responsibly. And so now Biddy Rose is hoping to send her youngest child to college. She's hiring other people for the harvest. She's thinking about buying a television, the first television in the village, and she's already worked out her business model. She's going to charge people to watch soccer matches on it. You know, I guess what appeals to me about it is an example of people helping themselves. And this model of these village savings and loan is actually spread by itself to other nearby villages, because villagers see that it really raises living standards, and so it just spreads on its own to other, even across the border into Mozambique. Just so powerful to see.
Well, and what struck me about it is you're essentially creating a strong foundation for a healthier economy in that community, because CARE could have come along and given her $2 instead of her taking a $2 loan from her neighbors, and or could have given her, you know, I could give her $10 or $20, right. But it might not have helped as much as that community savings and loan, $2 loan that she got from her neighbors.
That's right. And when people have a savings habit like that, then that also means that, I mean, one of the hardest problems for if you're poor around the world is that you don't have a mechanism to save. You don't have a bank account. You maybe don't even have an ID. In West Africa, there are money traders who will accept deposits. They charge 40% interest on deposits. And so people don't have any cash lying around. So when a woman is in obstructive labor and desperately needs a C-section to save her life, she dies for want of a tiny amount of cash. Or when a child needs a school uniform, there isn't cash around to buy it, so the child drops out of school. And so if there is a little bit of padding, it's not just financial empowerment, although it certainly is that too, but it expands education, healthcare, and just so many other aspects of life.
This idea of good intention not being enough, but sort of thinking smartly about how how we help other people. And smart, thinking smartly about philanthropy, not all efforts succeed. And maybe you could tell us about the clean cook stoves, because that's an idea that just seems like an obvious thing, like I should support this.
Right. There's been you know, a real push for clean cook stoves, partly because it's well known that most people in poor countries cook on open fires or on these really lousy old cook stoves that produce tremendous amounts of smoke. And this is a huge source of pollution, in indoor air pollution in these countries. And it claims more lives, as best epidemiologists can figure out, than AIDS and malaria combined. Women are the particular victims of this because they're the ones who are doing the cooking. And so then some smart people got together and designed clean cook stoves that produce much less smoke. And they worked really well in the laboratory. Everybody was very enthusiastic. The U.S. announced a $100 million commitment to it. And then in the first real careful randomized trial of them in India, they turned out they had zero impact at all on improving health care of people. And that, you know, it turns out it's so much easier to do things in a lab than in real work conditions where things break, where people maybe like their old stoves. And I mean, I don't think the lesson here is that clean cook stoves are a complete failure. The problem is undeniable. It's a huge problem. And now people are indeed developing better cook stoves that may actually address the problem. But, you know, one of the real lessons is we can't just operate on hunches, and we need to have evidence. And every organization evaluates its own projects as tremendous successes. So it's helpful to have randomized trials to give you more degree of confidence into what works or doesn't work and at what cost.
So get that evidence proving that something works, that's important for sort of kind of big overall like public policy sort of stuff. But for us individually, say for example, I have some money I want to give to a charity, there's the information available to me now to know where that might work the best. There's a lot more out there. I think of sites like GuideStar, where I can go to tell me about GuideStar.
Yeah. I mean, there you have GuideStar, you have Charity Navigator. One that I think is interesting because it really tries to – it's hard to measure impact of charities. I mean, it's much easier to look at financial ratios and things like that. Impact is more difficult. And so one organization that looks at impact is called GiveWell, started by a couple of former hedge fund guys who were – you know, they were trying to apply kind of their business sense and their metrics to the world of charity. And so they offer some suggestions about where donations can be most effective. And, you know, we in a path of peers, we try to recommend some, like the example of BT Rose that you said. So, you know, CARE can bring somebody else into a program like that, a Village Savings and Loan, for $25 a person. It's, you know, it's so cheap. Likewise, some of these other interventions, deworming is incredibly effective at getting more kids in school and costs 50 cents per child per year.
And some minerals like zinc, and I was surprised. I don't think about these things.
Yeah, we think of hunger in terms of not getting enough calories, but very often the problem is not getting micronutrients. And so things like zinc or vitamin A or iodine, and those, especially early in life, they have a hugely important impact, even in utero, sometimes even before a woman knows that she's pregnant. It's so important to get access to those micronutrients, and it can be done incredibly cheaply, but, you know, too often it isn't.
New York Times op-ed columnist Nicholas Kristof is with us for the hour. If you want to join the conversation, the telephone number is 1-888-477-9499. What are your questions about the best way to practice philanthropy in your life? You can also email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You know, I mean, I think most of us know that people are generally good. We want to do good things in the world, and we want to help people. But we're also hardwired to do that in a way, aren't we?
That seems to be the case. And the assumption is that we evolved because if there was one, you know, ancient tribal clan where people looked after each other when a saber-toothed tiger was attacking or when a rival tribe was attacking, then that that group of people had a evolutionary advantage over another tribe where everybody was kind of fending for themselves. And so we see it in brain scans, actually. There are these pleasure centers in the brain that light up when you are flirting with somebody, or you're eating nice food, or you're having sex, or somebody compliments you. And indeed, if somebody gives you money, then they light up as well, because it, you know, absolutely feel happy when people give you money. But it turns out that they also light up when you give to a good cause. And for about half of Americans, they light up as much or more when you give as when you get. So one of the ironies is that, you know, pure altruism is really tough because there is this incredible selfish pleasure from being altruistic.
And it's not always what you're saying. It's not always about the other person. I mean, there are selfish reasons for giving, and there might even be evolutionary advantages. I mean,
there are some fascinating studies on this. One study of Harvard graduates followed them for decades and looked at what correlated to longevity, and it turned out that, you know, a pattern of giving correlated better to longevity than cholesterol levels. There was another study I loved that found that for elderly people, that if you that joining a religious organization was associated with a 29% reduction in mortality rates, exercising regularly with a 30% reduction, and joining or volunteering for two or more organizations with a 44% reduction in mortality levels. So there's, you know, it's not just the pleasure that we get, the sense of fulfillment, enrichment, but there's also something pretty basic. We are social creatures, and we live better, we do better when we do engage with others and with some kind of a cause larger than ourselves.
And it's never simple, though, is it? Because when you think of things like raising money for a good cause, sometimes it can be easier to raise money to build a building that you can put somebody's name on than it is, you know, to buy a bunch of mosquito nets for people, or, you know, other smaller things that might be more effective.
Yeah, I mean, anything you can put a name on gets hugely over-invested in, and things that you can also put a face on. You know, we want to help individuals, and there are so sponsorship organizations do very well, but, you know, providing iodine or zinc, as you said, is, you know, that's really hard to get people excited about because it helps a broad class of people and doesn't really help individuals. And there's pretty good evidence that basically our pathways for empathy and compassion are emotional pathways. They're not rational ones. And in fact, if you ask people to do math problems and then ask them to help a cause, they donate less because the more rational parts of the brain have been activated.
Yeah, and talking about sort of these big picture issues, we got an email from Amy, and she says she wants me to ask you about good organizations that help the environment and address global warming. This is something that can be difficult to sort of get people motivated unless they have a personal experience.
That's right, because you know, we evolved again, you know, through evolutionary times to have, I think, in many cases, like an instinctive fear of snakes, for example, because over the millions of years, somebody who had an instinctive fear of snakes was probably a little bit more likely to survive than somebody who didn't. But we haven't really evolved to fear slow-moving changes, certainly not slow-moving climate changes, because that was not the kind of threat that would have been beneficial to people to address. And so now we're facing this new kind of threat, and we just kind of shrug at it. I should say that in a path appears, in all candor, that we're not really focused on environmental issues. We're really looking at how to create opportunity. Our argument is that talent is universal, but opportunity is not, and so that's our focus. And but I certainly think that, you know, the addressing climate change is a hugely important issue that has to be higher on the agenda.
But that seems like an especially difficult one to sort of find that place where I can focus my effort, you know, aside from whatever I do, you know, choosing to drive less or installing a more efficient heater in my house or something like that. It's hard to kind of identify that place where I can really have an effect.
Yeah, there is. There have been some interesting experiments to try to give people this satisfaction of, you know, that they individually have made a difference, or try to credit them, and then people are much more likely to, you know, to drive a smaller car or to adjust their thermostat, that kind of thing. But there isn't. You know, people are really reluctant to move, you know, to something like a carbon tax, which would really begin to address the problem in a broader way.
We received an email from someone who says they run a food cupboard as well as helping an individual family. And in both cases, the work is very satisfying for this person. But this person says it gets they get discouraged because things seem to happen so slowly.
Well, first of all, to that emailer, you know, bravo to you. And, you know, it really does make a difference, and especially for pregnant women or, you know, small kids who are using that service. That really does – access to good nutrition is going to shape that child for decades to come. It is true that a lot of charity efforts in this country tend to be kind of piecemeal, and we would never think of constructing a – interstate highway system by having individuals go out with shovels and, you know, add a foot to a highway. And in the same way, I think there are some kind of safety nets or interventions, certainly the education system, that really have to be done at a national and state level in this country by governments. And I think it's great when individuals, you know, try to patch up the net and do what they can. But we also need advocates who will push the buttons and try to get governments themselves to do a better job.
Our email address is really firing up here. We got an email from Anne. She says, I'm trying to be an optimist, so I really appreciate this program. She says, it reminds me of the Mr. Rogers quote, when a disaster occurs, look for the helpers because they're always there.
Yeah, and boy, you know, people, since I spend much of my career covering genocide and sex trafficking and all kinds of, you know, global poverty, all kinds of desperate things, people sort of assume that I must be a sort of grim pessimist. And in fact, one of the things you learn from those kinds of issues is that side by side with the worst of humanity, you see the very best. And so you see people who, when challenged, show enormous reservoirs of courage, resilience, compassion, and altruism. And so I managed to come back from, you know, a trip to Eastern Congo or somewhere, actually feeling better about humanity and actually seeing real progress, which is one thing we try to underscore in A Path Appears.
Yeah, we're so complicated.
complicated.
And it really goes back to that nature of, you know, we might have some predisposition to help, but it might be out of a selfish interest that we're doing that. So it just, you have to navigate these things. We're talking with Nicholas Kristof. He's our guest for this hour, and we're talking about people around the world doing good work and how they're succeeding. If you have a question or a comment, you can call us 1-888-477-9499, or you can join the four or five other folks who have emailed in at radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us. That address is @whyyradiotimes. We'll be back with Nicholas Kristof in a minute.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2. Or online at iamconcerned.org.
Made in China, prosperity manufactures a call for greater freedom.
Thousands of people joining can show the Chinese government and the world how determined we are in wanting democracy.
What political genies are out of the bottle in China, and what can Beijing do about it? That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Rachmaninoff with the Philadelphia Orchestra. Yannick Nézet-Séguin leads the youthful First Symphony. And Jean-Yves Thibaudet plays Cacciatorian's Piano Concerto. Tickets at philorg.org or at 215-893-1999 today. October 8th, 9th, and 11th at the Kimmel Center, Rachmaninoff with Yannick Nézet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking with New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof about people who are doing good things in the world and succeeding. His book that's out now was written with his wife, Cheryl Wu Dunn, and it's called A Path Appears, Transforming Lives, Creating Opportunity. If you have a question, you can call 1-888-477-9499. Sometimes when I think of philanthropy, I think of those ads on television that seem designed to make me feel really guilty and part with some cash, you know, for I can think of any variety of them, right?
Yeah, I think that especially the secular world kind of too much tries to guilt trip people into donating and sees this as kind of the right pious thing to do, but is something that is painful and solitary. And I actually think we have something to learn from the religious world, especially from megachurches, which have – I didn't know much about megachurches until we began really reporting for the book. And it was striking how – I think one of the ways in which they have become successful is that they make giving this social activity and this joyous activity. And they're not embarrassed about the fact that donating or engaging in a cause larger than yourself should be really rewarding and should feel good. And, you know, I think that's a really healthy attitude. And I also think that, you know, the secular and religious worlds have to cooperate more on advocacy, on issues that they care about. Because, you know, if on those rare issues where right and left actually agree, we could make have so much more impact if we had coalitions.
One of the big churches that you visited was Willow Creek Community Church outside Chicago. Tell me a little bit more about that church.
Sure. It's run by a guy called Bill Hybels, and it is huge. And it has about 25,000 people who show up at its each weekend services. And Bill Hybels is very much committed to – he's kind of a – I mean, a lot of the megachurches are more kind of sharply to the right. I'd say Bill is much more kind of down the middle. And he's very engaged on getting members of the church to support people locally and to support people halfway around the world. So he's been active in Africa, people supporting programs, sending – members of the church halfway around the world to on mission trips, but also locally. You know, they have effort to provide meals, to provide daycare, to if somebody needs a car to get to their job, they have people who donate their ability, their services, car mechanics to get that car working again. The whole range of skills, and it's something that the church takes pride in, and really, I think, is a reason for the amazing success of that church.
And how do they make it feel good and joyous instead of a guilt trip? Like, what kind of things do these churches do to change that?
You know, they celebrate it. And, you know, look how much we've raised for this. You know, they try to look at the impact. They get people engaged to see the people that they're helping and see the impact there. But I think maybe above all is just kind of an attitude that it's really seen as something that is wonderful and joyous and a reason to celebrate rather than as something that should just be, you know, a painful, a hair shirt kind of thing.
We have just about 15 minutes left with Nicholas Kristof. If you have a call or a question, call us 1-888-477-9499. We're going to go to the telephone and we have George from Newtown Square. George, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, I'm delighted to be on your program. I've read partway through the new book, and it's really very good. I notice you do talk about advocacy in general terms, but there's such a disconnect between people's charitable instincts and their willingness to nudge government in the direction needed to solve these problems. We can solve worldwide hunger with a modest expenditure. We spend so little on foreign aid to such a tiny, less than 1% of the federal budget and so forth. We spend less than we need to, obviously. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, sure. I think that you're right, that we tend to think that kind of making the world a better place or having an impact is really about writing checks. And, you know, that's one way to do it. But for most of us, we may well have more of an impact and make more of a difference, not so much by the checks we write, but by the letters we write or the petitions we sign or the phone calls we make. And, you know, one individual may not make a difference in national policy, but we talk about groups like the One Campaign or like Results at results.org, which have kind of given volunteers information about global health issues like tuberculosis and lobbied their member of Congress for more funding. And it's not as if any member of Congress is really against tuberculosis funding, so they're not getting calls from other people saying, you know, don't fund tuberculosis. So it's really just a question of getting some kind of critical mass of people who care about these issues, and then it tends to happen. And those results volunteers, I mean, they've plowed more money into some of these causes than Bill Gates could have done, even with all his billions. So don't discount advocacy, and also don't discount volunteering. You know, mentoring. There's a huge need for mentors for teenage boys, especially.
And I think for motivating myself, what I tell myself I'm going to be doing might change how I feel about it. Like if I say I'm going to end hunger, that feels overwhelming to me and hard to sort of get started on. But if I say I'm going to volunteer at this place that feeds individuals who I can see them, that feels different.
Yeah. And I think we can also, it's also a way of kind of modeling behavior for kids, because if you take a kid along on an effort like this, I mean, they see a world that they haven't encountered before. And one of the fascinating things about America is that the bottom 20% of Americans actually donate more to charity than the top 20% as a fraction of income. And it seems to be that the reason is that if you're wealthy in America, you probably live in a wealthy community, your friends are wealthy, you don't see needs around you, and your kids probably grow up also insulated from that. Well, if you're poor, you know plenty of people who are poorer than you and who need help. And so volunteering can be a way of exposing yourself to the other America and your family as well.
Let's go back to the telephone. We have Phil from Frankfurt on the line. Phil, you're welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question for Nicholas Kristof?
I'm calling. The Philadelphia Inquirer just had an article ranking Philadelphia as the top poorest city out of the top 10 cities in the country. And I was wondering, are there any lessons from what people have done in third world countries to address poverty issues that we might be able to use here in Philadelphia?
One of the lessons is there are no silver bullets anywhere. But in a sense, they're a silver buckshot. You know, there are a lot of little things that help at the margins to some degree. And I think that maybe the intervention that would give us the most leverage that we haven't done more with is early interventions. And that is everything from, you know, helping at-risk low-income teenage girls who don't want to get pregnant, help them not get pregnant. And it would save money, give them long-acting reversible contraceptives like implants or IUDs so that a 16-year-old girl isn't going to get pregnant in a way that is going to derail her own high school career and leave her with a child who maybe won't get the best upbringing initially. Then it's working with there's a group called the Nurse Family Partnership that we described that does amazing work in giving kids a better start in life. Then it's preschool. It's ending the disastrous experiment with mass incarceration, which broke up families, and families are just a hugely important unit. So I think all these things put together, they don't solve the problem, but they begin to make a difference along the way for a lot of people in creating opportunity.
I want to talk a little bit about the business side of philanthropy, because I think a lot of us don't want to connect those two things. And you say that the charities are not very good at marketing themselves, not very good at tooting their own horns.
You know, they flinch at the idea. They spend a lot of time tooting their own horns, which is not effectively. and they flinch at the idea of marketing or other kind of professional services. And partly that's because they're trying desperately to keep their cost ratios down so that they'll do well on Charity Navigator. But at the end of the day, you know, it is so much more important to market something like bed nets that can save lives, or clean water, or girls' education that are transformative, than it is to market, I don't know, you know, Twinkies or Coke or whatever it may be. And where, so like ALS with the Ice Bucket Challenge, that that is going to result in a lot more money going to ALS research, and you know, more power to them for figuring out a way of making that cause and fundraising effort go viral. And I wish we had more of those kinds of efforts.
Well, that Ice Bucket Challenge, that probably wasn't a silver bullet either. I can't imagine that that was like the one thing that they tried and, you know, it succeeded wildly.
Yeah, I'm sure there, you know, you never really know what is going to go viral or what is going to work. But there's kind of an earnestness in the humanitarian world that I think discourages people.
And earnestness. So are you sort of advocating for more of what, like a sense of humor or what
yeah,
more human connection?
You know, I think, well, I'm struck that so many organizations have come up with videos, for example, about the importance of empowering women. And basically nobody watches these videos other than, you know, the producer's mother. And yet then Nike did such a video, and they brought in there's a Nike Foundation, but they brought in the team that does Nike's, you know, advertisements, their commercials. And so these are a team of mercenaries. So I don't know that they really cared instinctively about the issue, but they knew how to make an incredibly good video. And so they did a couple of videos about the importance of investing in girls and empowering women that have been watched, I think, 15 million times or something. It was just an astonishing number of times. And I think, you know, acknowledging the importance of professionalism in marketing is really important.
And so what is different between this video, this I think it's called the Girl Effect,
yeah,
that Nike produced, and these more earnest videos that you might have seen?
I think part of it is a playfulness. I think part of it in general is putting an individual face on a problem. And I think part of it is showing that things aren't just desperately unhappy and awful in ways that actually kind of turn people off, but rather that there can be a potential to make a difference, something that has a hopeful arc to it.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of think about the people you want to hang around. You want to hang around people that are fun to be around.
Funny and hopeful, yeah.
We got an email from Mary Kate who asks, what would you have to say about society's understanding of the difference between charity and justice? Not sure exactly where that question is going toward,
yeah,
but do you understand what...
I mean, I think they're kind of both are needed, and that one needs to engage in efforts that will give people opportunity, and you know, those are what we customarily think of as charities. And then there are also all kinds of justice initiatives, trying to improve outcomes in the criminal justice world, for example, that I think are also crucial. And I think they're closely interrelated. I mean, the you know, as I mentioned earlier, the mass incarceration disaster in this country, where we quintupled the number of people behind bars, had disastrous effects for the family and for boys especially who grew up in homes without dads.
I want to get back to the business side of philanthropy. And one thing you say in your book that surprised me a little bit is you like to see more mergers and acquisitions in the nonprofit sector. Explain that to me.
Sure. Well, one of the problems in the nonprofit sector is that there's no scale. So you have a lot of organizations that are started up. And part of that is that, you know, a lot of young people, maybe for somewhat cynical reasons, trying to impress colleges, they will start their own little organization. And then they'll maybe do great stuff. And then after 5 or 10 years, you know, they'll peter out. And in the for-profit world, there's an incentive, a financial incentive, for these small entities to merge. There isn't that in the nonprofit world, and so these organizations just kind of die out or become zombies. And it would be a lot of these organizations have so much more impact if they could scale up and operate, apply their model to more countries or more cities. But people are reluctant to, you know, to merge their mailing lists and their operations.
I guess that gets back to sort of the selfish part of philanthropy, is I want my name on it.
That's right. And you know, I love social entrepreneurship, and there are some social entrepreneurs who've done amazing things. We talk about some of them in the book. And Alejandro Gacatigas, who we talked about earlier, starting the Springboard Collective here in Philadelphia, is an example of somebody doing a terrific job filling a need that was not otherwise filled. But there are also an awful lot of people who could work within existing organizations and help that organization get a little bit bigger and do well, and it's already professional, it has proven its mettle. And so I'd encourage people to join an existing organization unless they have some special niche that just is not being filled.
What's your favorite story in the book? Is there one that just you when you go to a party, this is the one you want to tell people about?
You know, it's a little like choosing which of my kids is my favorite, but if you don't tell the people in my other stories, then I guess might be a guy called Ollie Neal, who was an African-American who grew up in Arkansas, rural Arkansas, a very poor school, a segregated school in the 1950s. And he was a very smart but kind of a troublemaker. And he made the school librarian, Mrs. Grady, cry. And one day he's skipping class, he's in the school library, and he sees a book with a risque cover, a novel. Looks kind of cool, but he's ashamed of the idea of checking out a book because he's a tough guy. And so he steals it and goes back, loves it, goes back, finds another book by the same author, steals it too. Well, all this leads him to become a great reader and becomes a lawyer. And it turns out later that the librarian had seen him steal it and then had driven 70 miles to Memphis to buy another book by the same author to put it in the bookshelf. And this transformed his life.
Nicholas Kristof is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and op-ed columnist for The New York Times. He's co-authored a number of books with his wife, Cheryl Wu Dunn, including Half the Sky, Thunder from the East, and China Wakes. Their latest book is A Path Appears, Transforming Lives, Creating Opportunity. Thanks much for being with us here
today.
Great
to be with you.
I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moskowain.